Mother, Mother Ocean, I have heard you call. Wanted to sail upon your waters since I was 3 feet tall. You've seen it all. You've seen it all.
Mother, Mother Ocean. A little philosophical there. One of my favorite songs, Jimmy Buffett. And it's apropos. Please join me in welcoming Alan Lishness. He's the Chief Innovation Officer, Gulf of Maine Research Institute. Hey, Alan.
Hey, how are you, Steve?
Have you ever been introduced with Jimmy Buffett before?
You know, I never have. It's a first, and it's great.
Yeah, you may want to put that on your voicemail, your outgoing message. You may want to add some theme music when you go around the office.
It's a great idea.
I love Jimmy Buffett. So good to have you here. I want to talk about the great work that's being done at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, both in terms of the science and what it means for our economy. But as I do with every guest, we start with a brief kind of introduction to you, you know, where you grew up, how you ended up here in Maine, and why we're so lucky to have you stay in Maine, as many of the thought leaders that we talk to. So why don't we talk about the early years of Alan?
Sure. Well, I was born in Bath, but I wasn't there for long. We lived in Brunswick, and I went to Brunswick High School, and then off to Gettysburg College, where I double majored in English and religion, so that I could come back to Maine and become an aerial photographer.
Let me get the sequence there. English, religion, aerial photographer, man of science.
Not so much a man of science. I am surrounded by men and women of science. I'm a bit more a man of education, actually.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And a component of that is, right, curiosity, right? People I've found have been most successful in business or in academia have this curiosity. And whether it's religion, English, photography, and some of the other things you've done, I always think that's a great – I look for that in terms of people I talk to in my business in terms of hiring. Because if somebody's curious and open to learning new things regardless of the realm, generally that's a good element in terms of somebody applying it to whatever their job is.
Couldn't agree more, Steve. That's actually what we're focused on the education side at GMRI is cultivating a science literate public.
Right.
So you rightfully ask, well, what's science literacy? And for us, it's critical thinking and problem solving and collaboration and communication, and of course, driven by curiosity and reasoning with evidence.
I'm a big fan of math and science. I think some of my early teachers would suggest that there's a bit of irony there, but we'll pass on that. So talk a little bit about after Gettysburg, you know, what your career path looked like that ultimately brought you to the Gulf of Maine Research Institute.
Yeah, well, it's kind of a curious thing because I realized that there was not a great deal of deliberation. There I was. I'd grown up here. I'd gone to college in Pennsylvania because my high school guidance counselor had a nephew at Gettysburg, and the guidance counselor was a history buff, and he loved the battlefield, and my best friend wanted to go there. So we wanted to take a week off from school and go visit Gettysburg College, and the only way you could really do that was if you had applied. So since I wanted to go with my friend, I applied. He really wanted to go.
Wow.
I didn't really care. We got something a little wrong. We landed there during spring break, and there were, like, no students there. But, I mean, we still had an awesome time. And he ended up not getting into Gettysburg College, and I did. So I ended up going there. So my life has kind of taken these semi-random turns. So I was there.
Isn't that funny how I always think it's fascinating, as you just mentioned, in terms of when you look back in retrospect, there are some elements of everyone's life that the randomness is just amazing. Because when you're in the moment, you think you're in control of your life. You think, oh, I'm going to have lunch today at Bernie's. Tomorrow I'm going to go see the Sea Dogs. And it's like this linear thing. And it's only when you look back years or decades later that you go, wow, how did I end up at Gettysburg? And how did I end up here? So that's fascinating. So, well, it was good for you, I'm guessing, and good for Gettysburg. And then what happened post-college?
Well, I had had a summer job working for a guy who was a physics teacher at the Brooks School in North Andover, but he had a summer cottage up on the New Meadows River because he and his wife had grown up in Maine. And during the summers, he was an aerial photographer. So, and it was a cool thing. Like, he'd fly out of Boothbay Harbor in a Piper Cub. He'd take pictures of people's houses, and usually they were kind of out on the porch, you know.
Right.
And then he'd land the airplane, develop the film, drive down to Booth Bay that afternoon and sell the pictures. And let me tell you, I've tried to sell a lot of stuff.
Right.
There's nothing easier to sell than, back in 1972, a color photograph of somebody's house from the air that you took this morning.
How could you say no?
If
somebody had
point.
An aerial, I mean, now we have Google Earth,
sure,
so satellites take pictures, but back then, nobody would ever have that perspective of their house.
That's correct. So it was just a crazy scheme, and it was wonderful. And so I had worked with him in the summer, and then he got to a point, he said, you know, and it's actually the year I was coming back from college, he said, you know, I'm kind of sick of teaching physics. I'm going to take this business full time. Now, again, not necessarily carefully considered, because
right.
there are a lot of people out on their decks on the ocean in February. But we kind of shifted over to a commercial framework. The leaves are off the trees. You know, you can kind of see the land a lot better.
Right, right, right.
So he would fly out of Wiscasset, and our darkroom was in this marina on the New Meadows River, and he would fly.
And obviously, this is pre-digital, so there may be some listeners going, darkroom, what is Alan talking about darkroom?
Excellent point. Excellent point. So 2.25 film format, which you may be old enough to remember.
Sure.
And he would drop an onion bag with the film in it right there at the marina. I'd pick it up. I'd go process the film.
He would drop it from the airplane.
Yeah. Yeah, he wasn't flying that high. It was a Piper Cub.
And, yeah.
You know, it was 1972.
So. That is an excellent story.
Yeah.
So he would take the film in the cartridges, put it in a bag.
Yeah.
You would be standing there.
Yeah.
It would then, to save time and to take advantage of kind of the time window.
Yeah. So I'd develop the film. I'd print an 8x10 of every image. In the meantime, he's flown the airplane back to Wiscasset.
Right.
He's driven to West Bath. He picks up my prints, still warm out of the processor, jumps in the car, drives down to Booth Bay Harbor, and sells them.
Incredible.
So, and we ended up having dinner money by 6 o'clock that night.
Okay, I need to, and Shani knows what's coming next, and it's part of my own self-indulgence where I go off on a segue into one of my stories.
Let's hear it.
Okay. I had an experience with aerial photography a couple of years ago.
Huh?
After hearing yours, I don't think I've ever said this on the show.
I'm not familiar with this story.
Okay. Here, let me set it up. And by the way, we have Alan Lishness, and we're not really, we weren't here to talk about photography. We're going to get to his role as Chief Innovation Officer at Gulf of Maine Research, but I love talking about photography. So a few years ago, one of our clients was Olympus Cameras, and we work with them on a sponsorship of the U.S. Open, which takes place out in New York, right by LaGuardia and Flushing. So we had a sponsorship, and DirecTV was also one of the sponsors, and they were doing the aerial shots. And people are used to every sporting event now, whether it's golf or even basketball games, where the aerial blimp is showing the outside of a closed arena. It's almost part of the presentation of sport now. You expect to have an aerial shot, right? So DirecTV said, hey, since you're a sponsor, would you like to have one of the Olympus photographers go up in the blimp while we shoot tonight? And I said, well, let me check with my client. And I said, well, what are the parameters? Well, the blimp is staged out in Caldwell, New Jersey, because there's certain, you know, New York has crazy air traffic control because you have JFK in Newark, so it's very, very both in terms of secure and also for other reasons. You don't want a blimp sitting around, right, at one of the big airports. And so I said, okay, well, the person would have to go there at 4 in the afternoon because we go live on the U.S. Open at 7. And because tennis, there's a variable if it's 5 sets or 3 sets, we may not get back till midnight or 1, depending on how long the tennis goes. And I go, well, that doesn't sound so bad. And they said, well, here's the deal on the blimp. There will be 4 guys up there, pilot of the blimp, a person who mans the $1 million video camera attached to the bottom of the gondola, and then the person who oversees the signage on the side of the blimp, and yourself. And each person brings 2 Gatorade bottles with them on the blimp. And I said, well, that sounds delicious, Gatorade bottles. And they say, well, to be clear, 1 Gatorade bottle has to be empty when you come on the blimp, and you should have one, which, of course, should contain fluid. There's no restroom on a blimp, right? So it's 8 hours. So I'm like, okay. And I said, any other good news? Well, it's so loud you won't be able to hear yourself because you've got to wear these heavy-duty avionic headphones, but you basically have two giant turbofans attached to the gondola. So picture a minivan with two giant motors, and the seats are uncomfortable. You know, because when you see it, you've seen blimps, right, Alan?
Sure.
All over the place. Goodyear blimp, sure, and they're all similar. And you look up at them, and you think, you kind of, at least in my case, I romanticized they're lighter than air, and they're beautiful up there. The reality is they're metal tubs that are designed really just for the functionality of, you know, they're not designed for comfort or tourism. So I asked my client, does anyone want to go up in the blimp? And when I explained the two Gatorade bottles, and when I explained all that, everyone said, no. And you know what? I said, I'm going to go on the blimp. Once in a lifetime.
Yeah.
And so I went there. I got my Gatorade bottles. I had a bunch of Olympus camera gear. I've got telephoto. I had a gyroscope stabilizer unit, which was sort of state-of-the-art. And I'm like, I'm going to go on the blimp. We get on the blimp, and the Statue of Liberty is referred to in air traffic control. So you're wearing these headsets, and you're listening to air traffic control, you're listening to the producer of the TV thing, and you're listening to somebody and the pilot. And so they refer to her as the old lady. Like, you know, airship one, go down the harbor, take a left at the old lady. And it's like, you know, it took me a while. Like, why are they talking about some old lady in the blimp? Here's where the story gets a little uncomfortable. Shani, have you heard stories like this that have gone a little uncomfortable?
I have. I'm not sure I'm ready.
I'm not sure. Sometimes we play music that kind of does the foreshadowing. Okay, and it's a little bit self-deprecating, but it's everything Untied Smart Talk with Steve-O is real, so I've got to be true to that. So we get to the U.S. Open, and we're at about 2,400 feet, I believe, and you can see LaGuardia, which is one of the busiest airports in the world, and you see we're flying above the U.S. Open, and all of a sudden the air traffic control comes on the headset, and it's like, psht, aircraft control to airship one, airship one here. Please go up to 2600. Go to 2600 and hold in this vector. Psst, air traffic control, we're trying to elevate. We're not able to. Psst, airship one, you need to elevate now to 20. You know, and what's the problem? Psst, we have a passenger. We have a weight issue.
No. Psst,
yes. Yes. Okay.
No.
I was too heavy for the blimp. Here's the problem. It was right at sunset, and so the helium, I guess it's helium, it wouldn't be hydrogen because I think we learned what happened with that, but the helium is very temperature sensitive. There's a guy with I don't think it's a slide rule, it's probably a calculator that goes, how much is the weight, what's the air temperature, what's the density, how long we're going up, and when they asked me the day before how much I weighed, I said 120.
Shaved it a little bit. Pride, you know?
I thought they were asking for a T-shirt. Who thought that safety was the issue? So it's like, how much do you weigh? 120. And for obviously we're on radio, but so people probably don't realize I really weigh 140. They probably
that's about right.
They may not get that. So what happened was, is we're hovering over, and so all the TV crew on the ground are listening. Everyone on the blimp is listening. Air traffic control is listening. Planes are buzzing around us, and literally they couldn't get up another 200 feet. Psht, come back again, airship one. You can't elevate. If you're not able to elevate in the next 5 minutes, we're going to have to vector you off to like Connecticut or something. And they're all looking at me, right? How uncomfortable.
What's that feel like?
Now that I'm reliving it on radio, this is a little bit therapeutic because this was a couple of years ago. And so finally, you know, the temperature went down, the blimp got some elevation, we get up to 2,600 feet, and everyone just kind of, the rest of the trip, they looked at me like, the guy said he only weighed 120, but it was one of the best experiences. We took out one of the windows, and I had a telephoto lens, and some of the pictures are actually here at TimeSmart. And at midnight when we were coming back, they asked for permission to go over Manhattan because there's obviously flight plans. Mm. And we were flying at the same level at the top of the Empire State Building.
Awesome.
In a blimp.
Yeah.
So somehow, by the way, for those of you that may not remember from 15 minutes ago, we have Alan Lishness here. He's the Chief Innovation Officer, Gulf of Maine. I went off on my Steve-O blimp thing, but it was more of a therapy thing than maybe entertaining. But you were into aerial photography?
Yeah.
And for that one day and that one night, I was into aerial photography.
Kindred spirits, brothers, really.
Brothers, almost. Yeah. That's what this whole TieSmart thing is about, bringing that together.
I like that.
And the lesson, and this is also maybe a public service thing, anyone going up in a helicopter or a blimp, I think, and if the pilot asks in advance how much you weigh, you got to put vanity aside. You've got to. I mean, from just tell them. Even from now on, I'm going to add weight to it. Just for the extra safety.
The margin.
If we need extra fuel, if we need extra, you know, helium, what could that hurt? Are we going to go up too high? So anyhow, let's get back to talk. So what happened after your experience with aerial photography?
So it was the aerial photography business, which I had alluded to, got a little skinny in the winter. So remember, this guy was a physicist.
Right.
So he's using oil to heat his new house in an apple orchard in Topsom. And he says, I think I could build a windmill that could generate electricity. You know, the wind blows all the time. That's what people say.
How long ago was that? Because wind was relatively new.
That would have been probably 1975, 1976. We started the Zephyr Wind Dynamo Company. Zephyr is a light westerly wind, in case you were wondering. And so it was a crazy thing. The Maine Times was a kind of a extremely progressive newspaper, and it was there in Topsom. And editor was a guy named John Coles, and he loved all this renewable energy stuff. So he wrote this story about us and what we were trying to do. And I went to the post office to get the mail one day, and there's checks in the mail. And it's people who want to invest in our company. Now,
just checks in the mail.
Checks in the mail.
I've never had that experience. What's that like to just have checks show up unexpected?
It's crazy.
Fantastic.
And it turns out that with good reason, there are some securities laws around investing. I mean, and there ought to be, let me say for the record. So these people are sending us money. And so then here's a kind of a secondary leap. So I'm getting the mail one day. And I mean, a lot of them were asking for information. I want to buy a windmill. So here's this little teeny company. And we're getting like 25, 30 letters a day in the mail. So in walks the local Volkswagen dealer, this guy we kind of knew from around town. And he says, geez, Alan, what's all that mail? And I said, oh, there's people interested in our windmill. And look, they're even sending money. So he decided to roust up a bunch of his friends and become investors. So sure enough, we had this company.
Wow.
So I worked there for a few years, and it was kind of classic.
Was the focus small wind? Because for regulatory purposes, they're small. In fact, we in Yarmouth, where I'm the chair of the town council, we recently passed a small wind ordinance because it comes up, it has to do with the height and it has to do with the power generation. No. So was the focus of Zephyr small wind versus what people see in the desert and outside?
It was. So we are building a turbine that had a 15 kilowatt capacity. And as I recall, it probably had about a 14 foot blade span. So yes, these were residential sized units. And we got one installed out at Rocky Flats at Rockwell's Test Center for the U.S. Department of Energy. We sold one in Sweden. We sold one to AT&T, which we installed out on Block Island. Wow. Our first one we sold to a guy down at Kittery Point, lived on the water, always wanted a windmill. Classic undercapitalized Maine company. So we worked at that for a few years and had some notable successes and some somewhat dry periods. And I got a call one day while I was at the windmill company, not earning enough money to support my lovely bride. And it was the Maine Audubon Society, and they had this energy department, and they wanted to recruit somebody to run it. So I said, yeah, I'll do that. And so I went to work for Maine Audubon.
A lot of people wouldn't associate energy with Maine Audubon.
No, but see, they're really into resource conservation and sustainability way back then. I mean, we're now up to, 1980 maybe?
Right.
Late 70s, early 80s. And as a matter of fact, that was the Jimmy Carter years in the White House where quite literally you could send a two-page letter to Washington, to some agency, in our case, the Department of Energy, and you'd get a check back for $10,000, $12,000, $15,000, and which back then was plenty of money. So one of the things we were doing, we took this old farmhouse that was on the property, it was probably built in the late 1700s, and we did a complete redo, because everybody was talking about these fancy new solar houses, and we said, yeah, but hey, everybody already lives in a house, what can you do there? So we put on a solar greenhouse, and we put up an electricity-generating windmill, and one of the things we put on were these crazy solar collectors made by this guy up in Newcastle. He took corrugated cardboard, painted it black, pulled a plastic bag over it, inflated that plastic bag by taking air from the room and blowing it through the collector and back into the room. Well, with those all that hot air in there, the temperature of that air would go up by about 40 degrees. And we were selling these things for $100 a piece. Wow. And again, and you know, it was really cool. So, and then that company, so Maine Audubon put these on their house, and then that company recruited me to go to work for them. They're up in Newcastle. They got bought by Down East Magazine, and they wanted a marketing director.
Wow, we just had Paul Dworn on. He was a former editor, and now he's a novelist down east. Yeah. They're up in Camden.
Yeah, absolutely. So they invested in the company and took a very active leadership role. So I went up there as marketing director. So I was up in Newcastle. And the guy from Down East, the owner of Down East Magazine, had worked at CBS for several years in New York City. So whenever he'd go to New York, I'd go with him, and he would pound on the door at Popular Science Magazine. And they'd say, you know, go away. Nobody's here. We're busy.
I love Popular Science.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Normally you would see it in dentist office for some reason. Yeah. That was like a key target for them. But all kinds of really interesting technology and
I was a little surprised not to see it in your waiting room, Steve. I mean,
I have it in my private
office. It's in your office. Okay.
I have it in my office. Yeah, I'm a little selfish with some of the high-end reading.
Yeah, no, I get it. So what we were was very persistent. So lo and behold, we got a call from Popular Science that one day. We want to do a story. And we go, oh, that's really cool. And then they come up and do the story. And then a month later, we get a call from Popular Science. And they say, so you're going to be on the cover. Well, let me tell you, that is an awesome thing to end up on the cover of Popular Science magazine. So we do. So all of a sudden, we sell 5,000 of these solar collectors, you know, just like that. And by now, they'd ended up with injection molded end caps and a special kind of solar glass. It wasn't cardboard and plastic anymore. And we sold them for $500 for a pair of them. And you got a $200 federal tax credit and a $100 state tax credit.
Wow.
So they cost you $200. And in what the copy line that I am the proudest of, and Steve, since you're in this business, I'd like your input on this. It was called The Son You Always Wanted. What do you think?
Son, of course, being S-U-N as opposed to S-O-N.
Play on words.
A little, what we call a little double entendre, play on words. Yeah. The son you've always wanted.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah, okay.
The son you always wanted.
Yeah, yeah. So $200, then the solar tax credits went away, and nobody wanted to buy solar collectors. And in the meantime, I'd gotten kind of tired of driving to Newcastle every day because I lived in downtown Portland.
Right.
My wife and I were redoing an old brick row house there, and she was getting a little impatient with me being away when the furnace caught on fire and stuff like that. So
perfect.
I decided I need to get a job in Portland. So one of the common threads between Maine Audubon and Hansen Energy Products was I had hired a company called ImageWorks, who was doing multi-image slideshows and three-dimensional computer graphics. So you would remember this being in the business. Remember the show Where's Boston? So ImageWorks did a ton of work for Unum, and they would do their big employee recognition show. So we'd travel around the country. We'd shoot the top salespeople. We'd get these 24 projectors working in unison. We would rent a laser writer that would spell their name across these 80-foot screens in Hawaii or wherever we were doing this. So the company, ImageWorks, had never had a marketing director, and they said, So here's your job, Alan. We're really dependent on this one customer now, and although they're a fabulous customer, it's not good to be dependent on one customer. Mm-hmm. And they were 80% of their business came from this one customer. So what I managed to do over a couple of years is I managed to shift 80% of their business to one other customer. So, I mean, everybody was pretty excited when we started getting all this work from the other customer.
Sounds like a win-win.
Didn't really solve the problem, but they're still my dear friends. And, in fact, our building partners with us at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute.
Well,
so it was from there, actually, that I ended up at GMR. I realize it's a really long story.
Oh, no, it's not nearly as long as my blimp story.
Yeah, well, but that was good.
Or as we say, airship.
Yeah,
but
airship.
Your story, by the way, you're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O on News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. We have Alan Lichtenstein. He's the Chief Innovation Officer of Gulf of Maine Research. So after the wind, the solar, this other company, how did that connect to your current role at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute?
So my thing about jobs, I usually have jobs for about 3 years. So you go through the cycle, and then you see the cycle starting up again. And I'd always say, this looks familiar. I've already done this. I don't want to do this anymore. So about this time, my old friend Dickie Anderson, who had hired me at the Maine Audubon Society, was on the board for this group called the Gulf of Maine Aquarium. And I had invited him. I was on the board at Landmarks, and he had been legendary at driving membership at Maine Audubon. Mm-hmm. So I had him come talk with us about how to build membership. And I was riding down in the elevator with him, and he said, so listen, how's your job going? I said, it's okay. It's just kind of starting up the cycle again. He said, well, we're looking for an executive director at the Gulf of Maine Aquarium, and we need to raise $6 million in a year and get this aquarium built. So my reaction was, well, how hard could that be? That sounds kind of interesting. So I interviewed for the job, got it. 26 years later, I note somewhat sheepishly that there is no aquarium, but we're doing other things.
Well, let's talk about the other things, but how did it transition from, I always looked at it as the, and this is down in the waterfront,
yep,
in Portland, right?
Yep.
Within the almost the shadow of Becky's Diner?
Absolutely, and that's the Gulf of Maine Research Institute.
Right.
And that's where we got to, and as with so many recently great ideas in the state, it had something to do with Angus King.
Wow.
Angus was governor at the time, and what the kind of the key piece of all this, we had been working with a teacher at Harrison Middle School in Yarmouth, and he was the what used to be called the shop teacher, and then I think it became industrial technology.
Is he still there?
He's not still there. An awesome guy.
My kids
guy.
All went through Harrison Middle School in Yarmouth. Wow.
Bob Morey, awesome guy. So here he is, and he's supposed to be the, quote, shop teacher,
right.
But he's really into computers. And this is way before most of us. This is like 1990, before most of us are under computers and kind of just barely pre-internet. So he's got these rows of computers in his wood shop, and he's got these big monitors. And because he was a ham radio guy, he's built these antennas up on the roof. And it still blows my mind. He's receiving signals from NASA satellites. I mean, who knew? You know? So it turns out that the shop kids know half a day before anybody else whether there's going to be school tomorrow. Well, that's important information.
It
becomes really, really popular, and all these kids want to learn about computing and antennas and satellite images. And I'm going, geez, satellite images, what a great way to study the oceans, because, I mean, they're measuring surface temperatures and stuff like that.
Sure.
So,
see, and all I did in shop was I made this little wooden light thing.
Yeah.
And where it was like a trough. Yeah. And, like, the water trough made the little light thing. And that was the extent of, and this was back in the 70s when I went to glorious Needham High School in Needham, Mass.
Yeah, mine was a bookshelf, little bookshelf about this long with a couple of pieces of andiron that we had to bend on the ends. But so satellite image, I mean, this is really cool. Our trajectory, so we were raising money from little local and regional foundations, and we were setting up these satellite receiving stations in school. And, you know, we did like three or four of these, and I was getting these calls all day about DOS programming and stuff I didn't know much about, but we kind of struggled through. So then this Bob Morey goes to the National Science Teachers Association convention, a really big deal in Chicago, and he comes back, comes in my office, and I'll never forget, it was Thursday at noon, and I had just finished writing a proposal to the state of Maine for some funding for this satellite program, and he's waving this thing, and I'm going, Bob, what you got there? And he said, well, it's called an RFP, it's a request for proposals. Mm-hmm. So this is 1992, and the Republicans just won big time in the midterm elections, and Newt Gingrich is trying to eliminate NASA from the budget. So NASA says, okay, what do we got for resources? We got millions of satellite images. So they put out this RFP, and they say, anybody got any interesting ideas for what we could do with these images, because we got a whole bunch of them, for purposes other than science? So, of course, we're already in that space, so we're going, child education. So I'm looking at this 58-page RFP. I'm kind of looking at it closely, and I go, so, Bob, what's the deadline on this thing? He says, it's due at the close of business on Friday. Remember now, it's Thursday noon.
Wow.
And I'm going, I've never written a federal proposal. I mean, how hard could this be?
And back then, as you said, the internet wasn't really online, so research and typing had to be done manually. You couldn't just kind of like use technology to even help you with the process.
No, I didn't know the difference between a router and a server, and we had to budget them in this proposal, and we had about not many hours to do it. So I started writing stuff up, and I realized that I wasn't going to have enough time to write a lot of verbiage to really look like a federal proposal, but we've always been really visually driven. So I call my graphic designer. I said, Michael, you got to get in here. And, you know, of course, we stayed up all night. I was writing. He was drawing. And so we sent in this proposal. There were 563 of these proposals go in, you know, because everybody wants this federal money. Oh, and the other thing they said in the RFP, by the way, whatever your audiences are, use this new thing called the internet.
Whoa.
Yeah, 1992. So I said, okay, I had to come to grips fairly quickly with what the internet might be. So we send this proposal, and 563 of them we're one of 16 picked, and we're fully funded. And for us, I mean, we were spending at the time about $130,000 a year, and this was like $265,000. An interesting lesson. You could ask for $900,000. We couldn't figure out how to possibly spend it. So we take the $265,000, I think it was, and we start developing this website, and we said, hey, we're going to do 24 activities. Well, we actually did 48. And it turns out we had one of the first 600 websites on the World Wide Web, which we didn't know at the time.
Does it still exist now, the URL?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. You can find all our history stuff there. And, in fact, all that content we developed has been ported over to the GMRI site because it still gets hit upon really heavily.
One of the first 600?
One of the first 600. We had no idea. We didn't know. We just – NASA had all these really cool tools. Like way back then, 1993, they could tell us – what website you had been to before you came to ours, how long you spent looking at what stuff on ours, and where you went next. And they had these big monitors.
Wow.
I mean, this is 1993 by now. So yeah, we developed this website, and we got crazy, crazy, crazy. 14 million hits a year. We heard from all 50 states and 63 countries every 3 days. So that's how we got to the internet.
We have Alan Lishness here. He's the Chief Innovation Officer at Gulf of Maine Research Institute, also known as GRMI. Their website is since we're talking about the internet, www.grmi.org. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. That's a great story. And you know what's interesting about that, aside from all of it, is the internet is so pervasive now that it is now plays such an important role in everyone's life, you know. And earlier, when you came into the studio, aside from having state-of-the-art digital facilities, I keep an 8-track player in the production side with a stack of 8-tracks, which I remember, and I show them to some of the people who work here. Like, as an example, Shani, right?
Yeah.
Okay, Shani in her generation, and I'm not going to say how young you are, Shani.
Thank you.
But the socks that I'm wearing today are older than you are.
Oh.
Well, they're my favorite pair, too. but when folks of Shani's generation look at an 8-track, it's some sort of relic or some sort of Smithsonian thing, or they look even at an album. You know, I've got Yellow Brick Road by Elton John, which... it was a double album, and the artwork was unbelievable. And you remember, and I remember. Now people look at it and say, really? Somebody recorded an album. They put it on a bunch of plastic. It went to a big truck. They delivered it to a bunch of stores. A bunch of stores had to have electricity and space. And why would they go through all that when you can just go on the internet and download something? And it's amazing how fast technology in every area has changed our lives in every way.
Every day, it amazes me what the internet provides.
Right.
I couldn't agree more.
And I want to, as we go along, talk about how that affects the work that you all do at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute. I wanted to step back a little bit. You mentioned when you talked about the first kind of iteration of Gulf of Maine involved an aquarium.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever happened, because we obviously here in Maine have a relatively underpowered economic engine. I'm a big fan of the Old Port. I go to Becky's all the time. The pancakes, fantastic. Go there at 5 in the morning, hang out with the fishermen. Whatever happened with kind of the proposal and the hope and the promise of having a viable aquarium as a tourist attraction, and what was the history and what were the hurdles to that?
Yeah, well, we actually put a lot of years into that and really couldn't have been more serious about it. It's what I was hired to do. I was really interested in the challenge. We engaged with the business community, which turned out to be a in retrospect, obviously, a really important thing to do. They commissioned some feasibility work and came back and said, wow, you know what? This actually makes a lot of sense. And while we were kind of plodding along in this place where you don't launch new ideas overnight, big new ideas, people kind of have to get used to them, The industry was really changing. So, for instance, the last aquarium built in this country was in Atlanta, and it cost $250 million. So, as we moved, and you would know from your business,
sure,
to a more spectacle oriented use of our recreation time, for instance, that just the budgets just skyrocketed, and you don't have to be really heavy into finance to say, you know what, we're not going to raise and spend $250 million or $125 million to build an aquarium in Maine. And also, Angus King, we were going to Angus and saying, you know, what was interesting, the polling work we had done said 80% of the public in each of the 16 counties supported this idea. So there was amazing public support, mm-hmm, including helping to pay for it. And Angus said, well, he said, look, here's the thing for me, you guys. He said, I love what you're doing digitally. I love this internet stuff. I love this NASA work. This is the future. He said, but every single building I own, speaking as the governor of the state of Maine, almost everyone needs a new roof. Don't build a building. Don't build a building. Don't do bricks and mortar. Do digital. Your digital stuff is amazing. It's getting great international reach. Keep doing that. And so what we realized is we had to really go back and figure out what the need was in Maine, what the most critical needs around the Gulf of Maine were. And
so that became the focus as opposed to the aquarium?
Correct. And it became the focus of what became the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, because it turned out there were a few things. There are actually 26 institutions that do marine research in the Gulf of Maine. I mean, who knew? And we finally pulled them all together and talked with each other and figured out who did what.
Can you define to people listening the, mm-hmm, Gulf of Maine? Because it's, you know, how far does it extend? Yeah. It goes,
sure,
beyond Casco Bay. And,
it does.
And what is the kind of the...
So it goes up to Atlantic Canada, so New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, border on the Gulf of Maine.
Okay.
And, of course, Maine, a tiny bit of New Hampshire, and Massachusetts, the kind of the north shore of Cape Cod. And the Gulf of Maine is kind of contained in that area, and it's typically described as a sea within a sea because it has a very, very interesting own circulation pattern, which has to do with the richness of marine life in the Gulf.
And a lot of that has to do with, obviously, the various fisheries that are part of that and,
mm-hmm,
the unique elements and the,
mm-hmm,
water temperature. And,
yep.
One of the reasons why lobster is such a kind of indigenous species here,
yep,
right?
That's absolutely right. Although, you don't have to read a whole lot to get the sense that that stuff is changing quickly. Our chief science officer was talking with us the other day in a staff meeting, and he had just done some analysis. It turns out that the surface temperatures in the Gulf of Maine have warmed more rapidly than 99.85% of the world's oceans.
Is that John Nella?
It was
he
John.
He was here last
it
year.
It was John. And it's one of the reasons I'm here, because he had such a good time when he came.
I know. And I didn't want to say this when he was here, but he was just such a great guest. And I did so poorly in science where at some point he was talking about isotopes.
Yeah.
And I had to Google isotopes.
Yeah,
I figured it out. I figured out the whole isotope thing.
Sure.
Hey, before we move on, you mentioned Angus King a couple
yep.
of times
yep.
and the role that he's played
yep.
in terms
yep.
of your research. A few years ago, when Olympia Snow announced that she was stepping away from U.S. Senate, I announced that I was going to run for U.S. Senate. And it was one of the most enriching experiences I've ever had. In a few weeks into it, this fellow named Angus announced he was always, and it started out as being one of the most frustrating experiences I had because everyone knew and respected Angus King so much, and obviously it's well-deserved, and Angus went on to win that political race, and I think he's done a great job, and he's really putting in, I think in all areas of politics, people go into it, and some people really fully engage in it, and some people maybe less active or less effective. But every week, you know, just a few weeks ago, Angus posted this picture. He was in the Arctic on a submarine, you know, and, you know, it was like the classic selfie shot where, you know, the submarine had popped up through the ice or something, and there's Angus King, you know, in the Arctic saying, hey, I'm doing, you know, I'm working with the Navy and looking at some sort of research project or something. But he really has, relative to science or computer science or laptop program, has been fairly progressive in the area of science and research and education, isn't he?
I'd go further, Stephen. I would say gigantically progressive.
Right.
I mean, most everybody knows that every 7th and 8th grader in Maine and all of their teachers and somewhere over 55% of high school kids have their own laptop computers. That's common knowledge. What people don't often realize is that that condition doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. It's right here in Maine.
Right.
So for instance, just to talk about the pragmatics of that, here we are, an ambitious marine research institution who always wants to do more than local resources will allow. So our question was, how can we broaden our funding model? Because, you know, people in California, generally speaking, have a lot of money, but they're not as interested in Maine students as we are.
Sure.
So we said, well, if you look at some of these big foundations, particularly those driven by the technology fortunes, they're really interested in this idea of a scientifically literate workforce. So what if we created and described a construct that said you can make investments in Maine as a digital test bed? Because there's no other place where every 7th and 8th grader and their teachers has a laptop with high-speed web access in every classroom. And lo and behold, it worked. We went to the Hewlett Foundation, whose primary focus is not education for Maine kids, although that's our primary focus.
Right.
And they said, yeah, we think we and the field could learn a lot by you running your vital signs program, where we have kids out looking for the absence or presence of invasive species, on the laptops. And they funded us for 7 years. The Noyce Foundation, similarly. So the Moore Foundation, so these big foundations, we found that if we can build a connection, even though we're up here in tiny little Maine, right, if there's relevance to what we're doing, they will send some money to help do that.
That's so important. We have Alan Lishness here. He's the Chief Innovation Officer, Gulf of Maine Research Institute. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB. Before we talk about, and I do want to talk about the specific work being done by GMRI, one of my first memories of science is in the early 60s, and it had to do with the space program. I've talked about it on the show before, where at that point, the Soviets were the first to put a capsule in space, and they shot up, they went out of the atmosphere, and I don't know if there was a monkey in it, but then they landed down. President Kennedy, JFK, famously gave a speech where he said, it is a national imperative and a priority, we are going to land a man on the moon by the end of this decade. And at that point, computer science was in its infancy. Nobody invented Tang, that delicious orange drink, right? The guys at NASA didn't even know if they had a propulsion system or they would have heat shields that could go to the moon. Forget about communication. How are we going to talk to people on the moon? Because back in 61 or 62, when JFK said, we are going to get to the moon, I am sure everyone at NASA looked at each other and went like, what? But it forced America and scientists to do the best of what we do, which is to set a goal and say, we can do this. And during that period, and obviously the space program brought upon hundreds and hundreds of scientific breakthroughs, whether it has to do with propulsion or materials or composites or communication or, again, Tang. And I joke about that, but there are so many, Velcro. You know, where does Velcro come from? Well, it came from the space program. But back in that period where computer science and the government was the first entity that helped create, you know, Al Gore, I think, has been misquoted, but the government stepped up and said, this is a critical element in terms of digital stuff. You know, local people and companies couldn't have done certain things on that scale. But something feels like it's happened in the last couple of decades where the general public is seeing, I don't know how to put this, but the general public is less connected to the importance of science, and whether it's how we fund schools or how we respect it. I grew up watching Jacques Cousteau on TV, with the Calypso and his son Philippe. And so I didn't know a lot about the ocean, but you know what? If Jacques Cousteau said, we are going down into the Galapagos and we've got this, you go, that is fantastic. And Shannon, you probably never even heard of Jacques Cousteau.
I've heard of
it. Okay, it's shameful. Go to YouTube and watch. Get yourself some Jacques Cousteau. And he was this French guy with a family, and they were just, and it was like science was interesting. Going to the moon was fascinating. Now everyone's, hung up on their own iPhone, and everyone has, and my view, we need to invest more in science. We need to invest more in education. And do you agree there's been a drop off in the public? And do you have any solution that we can figure out today?
Well, Steve, I tell the same story that you do, that in the 60s, we galvanized an entire generation around exploration and curiosity and engineering. And, you know, we got the people to the moon and we got them back safely, which was the declared mission. What often goes undescribed is that in order to lift these payloads into space, everything had to be lighter and smaller, so right. We had to make small computers. Well, look what has fueled the last 40 years right. of industry in this country. It's small computers and all the things related to them. So my view is, to answer your question, what do I think? I think we need, and we have staring us in the face, a grand challenge of similar import. If we say to America's young people, look, we need to address these climate change issues, and here's what it's going to take. And this isn't going to be just engineering. This is right. going to be policy,
behavior,
and it's going to be science, and it's going to
personal
be
personal sacrifice,
exactly.
all of it.
But it is a compelling call to do something important. And I think that's where we need to be, and I happen to think that events in the atmosphere are actually taking us there.
I had a guest a few weeks ago, a gentleman named Dr. Lown. He won the Nobel Peace Prize for inventing the defibrillator, the DC defibrillator. He's 91 years old, and he was also part of a group, Physicians Against Nuclear Proliferation, in the 60s and 70s. So here's a Nobel Peace Prize winner, this wonderful man, wonderful interview. And I asked him about what he sees as concerns in 2014. And here's a man who's been alive for 90-something years. And he said climate change is a much bigger threat to civilization than nuclear. Because most people see the nuclear imagery or Hiroshima and they go, man, nuclear is very – and he goes, yeah, the issue with nuclear, it would be it would have been and would still be horrible if we ever get into a nuclear war, but there would be a limit to how much of the planet we could destroy. If we're not careful and if we're not responsive to what's going on in the climate, the whole planet and the whole ecosystem is in jeopardy. And he said the number one threat, forget about nuclear, it's climate. And here's it. And I also had some folks from UMaine. They have a climatology group of 72 scientists, and I had one of the folks there, and I said, well, out of the 72 scientists, does anyone ever come to your meetings and say, hey, I don't believe it? And he just laughed. And I don't know how to get through to people. And many of our listeners right now, it's Saturday between 11 and 1, and they're driving out to Home Depot and Lowe's. And, you know, there are some people who look at it as either a political or a position of ideology. And to me, it's science. None of the scientists I've talked to care about politics. All they care about is, well, you know, we went up to Antarctica. We did isotopes there. You know, we've got acidity in the ocean. We've got water temperature stuff. It is not within the normal variance or the cyclical nature of environment. And we have data that goes back millions and millions of years, billions of years. We've got to do something. But why doesn't the public, you know, it's urgent. There's exigency. Why aren't people jumping up and down going, let's be serious about this?
Well, and I don't know. You know, I'm not a social scientist, but I'm a citizen, and I read a lot, and I think it has something to do with this curious thing that you as a political person would be intensely aware
You're
of.
You're going to start insulting me now by calling me a political person.
I'm
kidding. I consider myself a government or a public servant. I hate the politics of politics.
What I'm saying is. When you participate in that right. sector, you tend to be thoughtful about a lot of things. And I think what the big difference is, and it's really only happened in the last decade, where all of a sudden almost all of our elections are polarized about 50-50.
Right.
And you remember that didn't used to happen. And because it has happened, government can make no progress, and obviously we see that all over the place.
But I don't know how science came into it. There's personal ideology, and there's human rights, and there's all kinds of things where I think different parties and different people can disagree. But somehow we've gotten to the point where people want to almost contest gravity.
Right.
And to me,
yeah.
climate change, when you look at the real data, there's not a lot that's subjective about it. It's pretty clear. And it would be like somebody saying, well, I just don't believe in gravity. Respect my view. And part of me wants to say, I respect you as a person, but I don't respect that view. And for whatever reason, I don't think people are being as serious about this as they really need to be, because the big change won't occur in your lifetime or my lifetime, but in my children and my grandkids, I think it affects the ecosystem, the food system, the water levels. Greenland's melting. There could be a 16-foot sea level change, which would be devastating for Maine. But people aren't listening. Right now, are you listening? I'm going to hit the microphone. Are you listening? Climate change, we need to change our behavior. And it's not the... Shani, are you listening?
I am listening loud and clear. I hear you.
Okay, so Shani, you hear me. And the millions of listeners, I want millions. And I don't want it to be like this alarmist thing, but we have to start with a point of awareness. Then we have to start at a point of understanding. And then we have to be, okay, let's be cognizant and let's start having better policy, better technology, better energy decisions. Right,
and Steve, we think you recall I opened by saying that our educational goal is to cultivate a scientifically literate public,
right?
And we think that's the way to get there, because one of those qualities that makes up science literacy is reasoning with evidence, and
sure.
And I agree with you. I think anybody should be able to think whatever he or she wants to think, and declare it as such, and that's your point of view, and you're entitled to it. But in matters scientific, evidence is evidence. And we need to get to it. And I guess my real confidence lies with younger people. We're working with middle schoolers. We're starting with middle schoolers. And, for instance, our newest program called Powerhouse connects kids to their household electricity use. And so they can literally alter behaviors in their own home.
With the smart meters and using that technology?
Yep. So Central Maine Power Company is a giant partner of ours. As soon as we sat down with them and said, hey, we'd like to engage middle schoolers, 7th and 8th graders, with their household electricity use, could you see that working? And they said, yeah, absolutely, of course. We can figure out the privacy stuff, the permissioning stuff, can make sure nothing bad happens to that information. Sure, that's an important functionality of smart meters. So we now have kids connected to their own smart meters to look at their own energy usage. And the functionality that I'm really excited about, we just added CO2 impact of your electricity decisions at home.
Wow.
And it's a mind blower, because the difficult thing for kids is to understand big global concepts, because they don't feel like they have a lot of power to change these things. I mean, what can I do? Isn't it because of coal plants in China and coal plants in Ohio? And when you can actually see how much you can alter your own carbon footprint and reduce your electricity consumption, which, by the way, will save you money, you become a more informed consumer. So we think over a 20 or 30-year period, we can actually get there.
By the way, we have Alan Lishness here. He is the Chief Innovation Officer, Gulf of Maine Research. We only have a few seconds left, and you're going to have to come back for part two, because we've only scratched. I've got to page one of my notes. But one of the things I want to talk about, because of the work that Gulf of Maine is doing, is actual Gulf, green crabs.
Mm-hmm.
What's
mm-hmm.
happening with the ocean? Also, there was a report recently in the last week talking about, and I know this may not be the right scientific phrase, but baby lobsters, because if the harvest for lobsters is 5 or 6 years, there's an indicator showing that if there isn't a solid generation of baby lobsters, that the fishery, in this case lobsters, could be impacted. Something feels like is happening in the Gulf, whether it's acidity or whether it's water temperature that you mentioned, and I don't think people realize how delicate the eco balance is between plankton and then small fish. And then give a quick overview of your thought on whether it's invasive species like green crabs that are destroying clam flats, which in my town of Yarmouth is a really big issue. In fact, we had a class do a video talking about green crabs and what we could do, but also lobster, which is, lobster is more than just a big economic impact in Maine. It's part of our identity. And if we lose the lobster industry, it would be an incredible blow to Maine. Well, part two, love to have you come back in the next month or two. Really, thank you for being here today. This has been great having you here, Alan.
My pleasure, Steve. Thanks
so
much.
Our guest has been Alan Lischness. He's the Chief Innovation Officer at Gulf of Maine Research Institute. Go to their website, www.grmi.org. They're doing interesting work. There's a lot to read about what's going on in the Gulf of Maine that impacts our students in terms of the academic world and also the research they're doing. You've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. Thank you.